Good afternoon, and welcome to the second in a four-part series on May a Jew Profit From. And each week we're covering a different item. So last week the topic was non-kosher food. That was with Rabbi Ziering. This week the topic is medicine. Next week Rabbi Ziering is covering weapons and arms sales. And then I forget what I'm doing the last week, but hopefully I'll know by then. It's on the flyer that went around. So I want to thank Steve Roth for making this series possible, as always. I know he's very busy today, and hopefully he'll get a chance to listen to the recording, as well as Reem for taking care of setting everything up, the copies, and so on. Okay, so the issue of making a profit from medicine is one that has been in the headlines the last couple of years for companies that have made too much profit from medicine, so much profit that it's been a source of controversy. Here in Canada, we have the scandal of Valeant Pharmaceuticals. So Valeant has a whole bunch of problems, which are not limited to the issue of the prices of the medicine. But if you take a look at source number one, I found this great graph, courtesy of the New York Times. A graph of list prices of various drugs now owned by Valeant. Each of these drugs was acquired in 2000 and... Actually, three of them were acquired in 2010, according to the fine print at the bottom. Not clear on when each was acquired, but for each of them, what you do see on the chart is a spike in the price. In the case of Glumetza, you see it go from somewhere around $900, for 90 tablets, up to $10,000 for tablets. You see with Cyprine and so on, you can go down the list, Cupramine, Isuprel, the price goes, it really skyrockets, and for conditions that are very serious. Diabetes in one case, Wilson disease in another. Wilson disease is a disease involving absorption and digestion of copper within the system, and it can be fatal if it goes undiagnosed. It causes damage to the liver, it causes damage to the brain, and then you have the slow or irregular heart rate for Isuprel. So, when you see a company acquire a drug, which means that the company did not actually do the work of developing the drug, and then jack up the price for it, inevitably that gets people angry. Like, does that mean that beforehand they just priced it entirely inappropriately? They weren't expecting to make any money or even to survive on it, and now this is what has to be done in order to survive. It's very hard to justify, and it angers people. And another case of it is the recent case of Mylan Pharmaceuticals with the EpiPen. Another case, one that made the headlines across the United States last year, was Turing Pharmaceuticals, with the raising of the price of a drug called Daraprim for toxoplasmosis, which actually has a strong connection to the Jewish community, not the disease, but the drug, because Daraprim was originally developed by a Jewish woman, an immigrant from Poland named Gertrude Elion, and she won the Nobel Prize for her work in chemistry. There's a whole saga of very, very worth reading about her.
Is that the guy that appeared before Congress?
That's the one. Martin Shkreli was the CEO, yes. So he's the one who appeared before Congress. You got it. So we're dealing with what is fundamentally a complex issue. It's not a simple issue. It's not as simple as saying, well, these companies are evil and they're raising prices and they're costing people their health. It's not that straightforward. If you take a look at source number two, an article from the New Yorker called "Everyone Hates Martin Shkreli, Everyone Is Missing the Point." Source number two, House member Elijah Cummings acted as if Shkreli were the only thing preventing a broken system from being fixed. Right? In other words, it's your fault for running up the prices. Cummings has been in Congress since 1996. He's a firm believer in the power of government to improve industry through regulation. And yet now he was begging the former CEO, former because Shkreli was then out, he was under investigation for a separate problem, but he's begging the former CEO of a relatively minor pharmaceutical company to, quote, change the system. It seemed like an act of abdication. If you believe in government regulation, why don't you come down on the pharmaceutical industry? Why are you allowing them to do whatever they will? You are empowered to create laws. You are empowered to regulate. And clearly the answer for why it hasn't been regulated is a combination of the complaints of the drug companies, which have heavy influence, and they're able to tell the legislator, you are not coming down on me, I'm an employer, I am a producer of medicine, you can't, if you make it hard for me to make a living, you won't have medications or you won't have jobs on your shores. And so that's one piece of it, is the weight that the pharmaceutical companies throw around. But the other is the recognition that if you make it unattractive for people to produce medicines for disease, the disease isn't going away, but the medicine can. You need to create incentives for companies to actually invest in this. And it's very hard to say, well, I'm only going to allow certain types of profits, and I'm only going to allow profit to a certain extent and expect the system to run properly. It's not simple and straightforward. And so what we want to address today are three issues. Number one, the opening question, is a Jew allowed to profit from medicine at all? Forget the question of too much. Are you allowed to make a profit on medicine? Or maybe we should say, you have an obligation to heal people. Go out and do your mitzvah. Second question is, assume that you are able to charge for certain things. Oh, that's all right. Thank you. I'd asked for it open before to help modulate the temperature. So the second question is that assuming there are certain things you're allowed to charge for, what is the cap on what you can charge? And then finally, if we have enough time in the discussion, the third question is the community able to act within Jewish law? Is the community able to act to compel a lowering of prices? Those are the three issues that we want to look at. So,
is medicine defined as pharmaceuticals?
No. Nope. We're going to be discussing medical care broadly, of which pharmaceuticals are a key component. So
isn't that corollary then that Milo's asked, is it true that I've become a pharmacist because he's actually benefiting from profits, which involves life-saving drugs?
Well, the question is not, is he allowed to become a pharmacist? Is he allowed to make money being a pharmacist?
Yes.
Maybe you should have a hobby as a pharmacist. In all seriousness, that would actually be the question. So,
one question.
Yes.
That question. I think you should break this down between the companies that actually invent and have the cost of inventing.
We're getting there.
And break down to the companies that are just making.
Right. We're getting there. You're right. We have to distinguish between producers and marketers, and we will, assuming we get there. So, there is a natural human instinct that says that financial means should not prevent people from receiving medicine. Right? People should be able to live their lives in good health, and if they can't afford medicine, then they should be able to receive it anyway. That's a basic, it's a basic instinct before you get to the question of, well, how are we going to pay for it? And the same thing regarding food. We don't like the idea of people starving to death, right? We assume that society somehow should come up with a way to feed its citizens. And the fact that we have yet to come up with such a way isn't a justification for that. It's a reality that we keep trying to defeat. If you take a look at source number three, this is a case you've probably come across in some form or another, known as Heinz Dilemma. A woman was near death from a special kind of cancer. There are various versions of Heinz Dilemma. This is one version of it. It's a classic version. A woman was near death from a special kind of cancer. There was one drug that the doctors thought might save her. It was a form of radium that a druggist in the same town had recently discovered. The drug was expensive to make, but the druggist was charging 10 times what the drug cost him to produce. He paid $200 for the radium and charged $2,000 for a small dose of the drug. The sick woman's husband, Heinz, went to everyone he knew to borrow the money, but he could only get together about $1,000, half of what it cost. He told the druggist that his wife was dying and asked him to sell it cheaper or let him pay later. But the druggist said, no, I discovered the drug and I'm going to make money from it. So Heinz got desperate. He broke into the man's laboratory to steal the drug for his wife. Should Heinz have broken into the laboratory to steal the drug for his wife? Why or why not? And we're not going to debate Heinz's dilemma now, as interesting as the debate would no doubt be, but the fundamental reason why this is a debate is because we say, well, saving lives should override a person's property interest. And you can come up with all sorts of cases that fit this. Within Jewish sources as well, we have the idea that people should not profit at the expense of somebody else's health, or to put it differently, their profit should not endanger somebody else's health. There's a classic passage at the end of Kiddushin in the Talmud, in which we are told, Tov Shebarofim Legehinom, which literally means, good doctors, or the best of doctors, are going to Gehinom, to hell. Now, what in the world are you talking about? Why this outburst against doctors in the Talmud? So, various answers are suggested. One answer that's suggested is because how do you become a good doctor? How do you become a good doctor? How do you become good at any profession?
Practice.
Trial and error. Sorry?
By making a lot of mistakes.
So the way he became the best doctor is by leaving a trail of bodies in his wake. That's one explanation. That's a crude way to say it. But that's one explanation. Another explanation is because the doctors who are the best tend to develop a high sense of themselves and what they're accomplishing, and to become arrogant and deny that that God is involved. And that's a second explanation. But take a look at Rashi in source number 4, who offers us two suggestions. One is, Eino Mesheber Libo L'Makom, he doesn't subdue his heart before God, meaning that he actually brings three ideas. Number one is the arrogance. Second, Pamim Shehoreg Nefasho, sometimes he does kill, meaning sometimes he will make a mistake and take a life. And third, he says, he is able to heal the poor, but he doesn't heal. He charges a lot of money. If someone can't pay, he says, then go to somebody else. So what you find Rashi stating here on this passage in the Talmud is the sentiment that if somebody refuses the needy for medical care, he is committing a horrific crime. And that's, again, this is a common human instinct. And indeed, Jewish law tends to object to charging for medical care because it is a mitzvah, right? How do we know that there is a mitzvah of healing others? Well, where is the mitzvah in the Torah of providing healing? So Rafai Rafai that Nathan suggests I would not go with, because that's permission for the doctor to heal. You're right. That is, it's brought in the Talmud as permission to heal, but that isn't an imperative. Where's the imperative, Gershon? Do not stand by while someone's blood is being shed. That would be an imperative. Another one would be, I'm going to come back to Nathan's source because it actually is problematic then. Why do I need permission if there's an obligation? If I have an obligation not to stand by, of course I'm obligated to heal, right? So why do I need a source that says he shall heal, indicating there's permission to? So there are various answers for that. One answer is because medicine has side effects, and therefore when you help somebody, you may also harm them along the way. Another explanation is because we have a concern that someone might say, well, God made them sick, so who am I to go in and heal them? So we have justifications for it. But one source for the obligation is lo samad adam rayacha, do not stand by while somebody is being hurt. Another source for it is the mitzvah of hashavat aveda. I have a mitzvah of restoring lost property. You lose something, I find it, I'm supposed to give it back to you. What's the difference between when someone loses a wallet and when someone loses their health? I have an obligation to restore it to them. Another source for it is love your neighbor as yourself. There are all sorts of sources that are brought to indicate this is indeed a mitzvah. And based on this, we get source number 5. A Mishnah in Nedarim. It's dealing with cases which I think were once a lot more common than they are now. The Talmud has a whole long list of cases in which a person takes a vow saying, I am not going to benefit somebody else. This was, I guess, a way to express yourself in the event that you were angry at somebody. So you swear you're not going to benefit them. And the question that's asked in a series of cases is, are you allowed to provide this type of benefit? Are you allowed to provide that type of benefit? So here it says, if somebody is not permitted to benefit somebody else, because he took a vow declaring that benefit would be off limits, mirapehu refuas nefesh, he is permitted to heal the person, avala refuas mamon, but he's not allowed to heal the person's property. There's a discussion in the Talmud is exactly what the parameters are, but that's the conclusion of the Talmudic discussion. If I say, I am not going to help you, I am still allowed to heal you. What's the basis for that? Why is that true? That I'm allowed to heal you if I just said I'm not going to benefit you at all? Because it's a mitzvah. I don't have the freedom to take a vow saying I'm not going to heal you. Because I have a prior commitment. Right? I swore at Mount Sinai to fulfill the mitzvot, which includes healing other people. So God says, it's very nice that you took your little oath saying you're not going to help that person, but it's overridden by the contract you signed at Sinai that said you are going to heal the other person. It's not up to you. So that indicates that providing health is indeed a mitzvah. And further, we say you're not allowed to charge for a mitzvah. An example of this, a key source, is number 6, in which we are told regarding teaching Torah. Rabbi Yehuda says, quoting Rav, he quotes you a verse from Devarim, the book of Deuteronomy, Re'ei limadati eschem chukim u'mishpatim, see, I have taught you all of the laws. Moshe says to the Jews, Ma ani b'chinam, I taught you for free. Avatem b'chinam, so too, you have to teach each other for free. From which we understand that Torah, you can't charge somebody for teaching Torah.
Is that just for Torah, for all these folks?
Ah, so Steve asks a very good question. Is that just for Torah, or is that something we're going to expand to mitzvos in general? And it does seem from the Gemara there that they expand it beyond this to say, in general, I am not allowed to charge for doing a mitzvah. You will ask then, why? What about the chazan who gets paid, or what about the rabbi who gets paid? So we're going to come back to that shortly in the when we discuss medicine and what the justification is for charging in those cases. But yeah, we have to ask the question for a broad swath of mitzvah, not only about medicine. Right, exactly. So this is what we have to then discuss. But as of now, if we were to, you know, to stop 15 minutes in, we would end up saying that no, you're not allowed to charge for medicine. And again, as Rabbi Ostriker pointed out, more broadly than just medicine, but medical care in general. So, having said all of this, we do have 3 grounds for charging for medical care. What might be a justification for charging after we've already said that you're not supposed to charge for a mitzvah? What will be the justification?
For your time.
Time meaning?
Well, you're spending time, but you could be otherwise earning money, and you're spending it doing something to help someone. That's not like charging for profit. That's just to recover your costs. So
right.
Opportunity costs for it.
Right, so one way to look at it is opportunity cost. I could have been a, fill in the blank, I could have made X amount, now I'm doing this instead, I want compensation from you. Now, what exactly X amount is a good question. You know, I have a degree in computer science, I studied towards a master's in computer science, so am I entitled to say, well, your average computer computer programmer would make X, therefore that's what I'm going to demand. Or do we say, you get a baseline salary. Because after all, you're enjoying what you're doing. If you weren't doing this, you know, you might be stuck doing that, but you're happy not to do that. Maybe, you know, in the same way that we talk about somebody who is supposed to do a job, is hired to do a job, and the job falls through. So you're supposed to compensate him. Do you compensate him as though he had done the job, or do you pay him whatever amount of money he would have wanted to sit at home that day? Which is presumably a lower amount in general. Not always, but in general. So, one way to look at it is opportunity cost. We're going to come back to that. What would be another justification for charging?
Because maybe leave the doctor into, God forbid, poverty because he has his own expenses. That's his family, his wife, his kids.
So, it's not good to the doctor.
If he wasn't doing that, he would get another job doing something else. That money would help him pay for his mortgage, his kids' education.
Right, so that's the opportunity cost idea, but there's a related idea to it, which I'm not sure if you're going into as well. Aside from opportunity cost, we want doctors. Right? In the event that we decide that we're going to tell all the doctors you have to work for free, you know, they're going to go to Alberta. Or somewhere where they can afford to pay rent. But you get the idea. Yeah, it's a practical thing. The community says we need physicians and drug producers and so on. Yeah.
They all have a cost of doing business. You know, Heinz, if he was selling his product for $100, would have lost money. If he was selling it for $150, you know,
right.
It's a cost of doing business. He would be losing money.
Well, right now, we don't know that cost of doing business has any significance. In other words, the answer could be, it doesn't matter, you can't charge at all. Or the answer could be, you can charge whatever it costs you. turn that over. That could be.
There's something else. Receptionists. Who's paying for receptionists? Who's paying for the nurse? Who's paying for this?
Right.
Nobody's working for free.
So this enters into a third justification for charging, and then we'll see some sources for each of the three. The third justification for charging is that there are all sorts of elements in running your medical practice or producing drugs that are not necessarily your mitzvah obligation. Right? I'm not going to do the teaching Torah example because you'll argue that every background step leads towards that. But certainly in terms of medicine, if I have an office and I have to pay for a receptionist, or if I have to pay for the paper on which we're going to write prescriptions, and how much of that are you going to really say is performance of the mitzvah, which you then have to do for free? So we're going to see some sources for each of the three justifications. It is very clear that there's a justification for charging for medicine. And actually, I'm going to go back to Nathan's source again. The Verapoyerape source that he quoted, in context, refers to what case? Where does this appear in the Torah? An attack on somebody else, injuring somebody else. One person injures another, and the Torah says there are all sorts of damages you have to pay. You have to pay for time lost from work, you have to pay for embarrassment, there are a whole set of costs that you're going to have to pay for the victim. And one of them is medical bills. Well, tell me something. How can there be medical bills if you're not allowed to charge? Clearly, from the fact that the Torah says you're paying for medical bills, that means there are medical bills. Now, you could argue maybe it's a non-Jewish doctor. Maybe. But I think it's more likely that you see in there an explicit, really explicit, I think, not just implicit, recognition that there is a basis for charging. So the first one is, in the order that I'm going to present it, that not everything involved in medical care is an obligatory mitzvah. And this is going to include a few different elements which we've discussed. Number one, the opportunity cost, the loss of time from other pursuits. That's actually, I'm going to include that in the not everything is an obligatory mitzvah. So that if you take a look at source number 7, a passage in the Talmud regarding a judge, because that's another one who's not able to take payment. The judges, I don't mean payment from litigants, but payment even from the community. And the Talmud asks, there is a judge by the name of Karna who did take payment. And I'm just going to use the English in the interest of time, but you see I brought you the Hebrew as well for those who want to read it there. How was this judge, Karna, permitted to take payment as salary for judging? Does the Mishnah not say, one who takes payment to judge, his verdicts are invalid? To which the answer is, that's payment for judging. We don't want you to take payment for doing a mitzvah. We don't want you to take payment for serving as a judge. But Karna took payment for not working. In other words, for not pursuing a livelihood in some other career. The fact that this is the way that he's going to survive. And that's broad regarding teachers as well. To say the justification for the teacher is, if I don't do this, if I don't get paid for this, I'm going to have to go earn a living somewhere else. So pay me so that I don't go earn a living somewhere else. That's one element of it. But there's more. Physical strain is also a part of this conversation. Meaning, there's no obligation within the mitzvah of helping others and even healing others that I should go to great effort, that I should engage in serious labor. So I'm allowed to charge for that. In source number 8, there's a discussion of this from the same passage in the Talmud that brought you source number 6, where we said that you're supposed to teach for free. So here's a question regarding a separate mitzvah. It's talking about water and ashes from the chatat. What this is talking about is the para aduma, the red heifer, which part of the ritual involves taking water, putting a certain set of ashes in the water, and then that water will be sprinkled on the person who is impure. Why? Look at Parshas Chukas and get back to me. This is one of the classic laws for which we have no rational explanation. So that's the ritual. And the Talmud here asks, you're telling me you're not allowed to charge for a mitzvah. We've learned the following. If a man betroths a woman, right, and this is talking about kiddushin, where he's supposed to give her something that is of value, right, something you could trade on the market. If a man gives a woman for this betrothal, for this kiddushin, the water or ashes from the chatat, from this para aduma, from the purification, right, she is betrothed. In other words, he is considered to have given her something of value. How is it that it's of value? You're not allowed to charge for a mitzvah. Abaye explained, that's no problem. One is the value of bringing the materials and drawing water. The other is the value of performing the purification rite, meaning I'm not allowed to charge for the mitzvah itself of sprinkling the water on someone who is impure. However, I would be allowed to charge for the value added of going to get the ashes, going to get the water. And that's what he would be able to charge for, and that is what he's offering her by giving this to her for free. That sort of payment for the effort that's involved. I brought you an interesting source in number 9. I always find this fascinating in this context. Rabbi Chiel Michal Epstein, writing in Lithuania in the early 20th century, the city of Novarduk, says that writing a prescription counts as strain for this purpose. Writing a prescription. I mean, honestly, it looks pretty effortless the way they scribble it out. Reading the prescription. Yeah, you're talking. Yeah. But that's what he says. And then a third example of something that is not part of the obligatory mitzvah would be acquiring the materials. Meaning the materials themselves cost the doctor something. The doctor is able to charge for the materials, or the manufacturer of the medicine is able to charge for the raw ingredients that they use in order to make the medication. I brought you source number 10. I'll explain it outside because it's not so clear from the text itself. It's talking about somebody who has been held prisoner and is afraid for his life. And he manages to flee. And he gets to a river. And the ferryman says to him, I see that you really need to get across, huh? And he says, you bet I do, get me across. And he says, well, I'm going to charge you. How much is it? And he says, I'm going to charge you a dinar. Dinar is a large sum of money. In fact, it's only a zuz or whatever it is. Some fraction of that is the normal cost for people who just have to go across the river. But he sees the guy's desperate. So what the Talmud there states is the fugitive is able to promise that he'll pay the exorbitant sum. And once he gets across the river, can pay him the normal sum. Because he can say to him, you only forced me into this out of desperation. That wasn't right what you did. But on the other hand, he has to pay something. There is something called the basic going rate because this person has a boat and this person maintains it, and there is a basic cost that is involved, from which we understand there is such a thing as a legitimate cost too. So the first thing is, not everything that's involved in care is part of the mitzvah, and therefore one could charge for that, whether that's your opportunity cost because you're not making money elsewhere, whether it's the cost of your strain, whether it's the cost of your materials. Second is, and this no one actually mentioned, come to think of it, why are you looking at me to do this for free? Right? There are how many doctors? It's not just my mitzvah. It's everybody's mitzvah. You don't want to come to me because I'm charging? So fine, go to somebody else. There are other doctors around. Why should this come back to me? Ramban Nachmanides, in source number 11, mentions this in his Taras HaAdam. The Taras HaAdam of Ramban is a major resource for medical halacha, medical ethics. You can see I wrote it there, 13th century Spain. But a lot of what he says ends up being the foundation of what is said later on. And he says, if one encounters a mitzvah which is incumbent upon everyone, and he will only fulfill it if he is paid, and then he collects payment for it, we don't remove the payment from him, meaning we may not be happy that he's charging. But realistically, he has a right to do so. Because he says, I'm not keeping you from receiving the service. And the mitzvah will be done. Someone else will do it. It's not mine in particular. You can't pin this on me. And that's the second justification for charging, is other people could do it too. Now, obviously, this is not always true. Go back to the EpiPen case, or the Turing Pharmaceuticals case. I'm not sure about the story with the Valiant drugs that we talked about in the beginning, but in both of those cases, those are the only things that are available. EpiPen doesn't have, as I understand it, a competitor. There is no competitor for toxoplasmosis, for Daraprim, primarily because, well, one of the things that the drug companies complain about is the high cost, both regulatory and in general, of competing with a generic, producing a generic. And the other is because the number of patients who face it in the U.S. every year is numbered in the hundreds or the low thousands, and it's just not sufficient for anybody to actually ramp up production to actually do this. So so in those cases, they can't use this as a justification. Turing Pharmaceuticals can't say, go get it somewhere else. It's not just my mitzvah. The answer is no, it's your mitzvah because you're the only one who has this. So this is a limited utility. The third argument is, we need drug companies. It's a reality. In order for us to survive, we need companies that are going to produce drugs. We need doctors who are going to treat people. And therefore, the community is willing to pay. I brought you source number 12, which shows that a community is able to make rules about measures, prices, wages, in the interests of the community at large. So even if the doctor is not justified in charging, the community is entitled to say, we're going to pay you anyway, because we need you. It's up to us to make that determination. Similarly, in source number 13, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein talked about this, and he said, in the 20th century, he says, don't make the argument that the doctor should find something else to do on the side. Right? The doctor is not allowed to charge, and if he wants to feed his family, let him also become a barber, or you know, whatever it is that doctors historically have done or would do. Let him be a day trader on the side. In between patients, he can track the market. So he says, don't say that. It is surely better for the patients to have a doctor who engages only in healing and does not confuse his thoughts and time with other matters. Right? You can just see what kind of a world we would live in if doctors had to pursue something else in order to be able to survive. Add to that the fact that doctors deal with high liability situations, right? Different legal environments will create different risks. But you're asking somebody to take risks in order to do this. I brought you source number 14, dealing with an entirely different case, but everyone likes to cite it, who writes on this topic. He's talking about a bill of divorce. Normally, and logically, witnesses are not paid for their role in legal proceedings. Right? We don't pay a witness to a document. If you want to lend somebody money and you want to prepare a document memorializing the loan, and you have two people sign saying we saw this loan take place, they don't get paid for doing so. However, in source number 14, they note the practice of saying to these witnesses, you are going to be liable if you mess up this get. You have to realize that the way that a get is written, it's written on parchment, and it's written it's not necessarily written on parchment, I take that back. But it's the way that it's written, the standard way that it's written, involves signing your name using a quill, and you could potentially, if you spill the ink and blotch things in some way or mess up your signature, you could actually ruin the get, and there's a cost involved in that. They have to hire the scribe, they have to prepare the materials. So some say in 14, some say, Rabbi Moshe Isserles writes in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, some say that one may stipulate that witnesses must pay if they ruin the get. And this is why they may receive great payment as well. Right? If you're going to hold me liable for messing it up, you have to pay me for my role in doing it. Alternatively, maybe they can charge because by acting as witnesses on the bill of divorce, they're now prohibited from marrying the divorcee. So that's just a basic rule of procedure. You don't want a situation in which someone can also be a witness on the bill of divorce and marry her. It's called a conflict of interest. But the point is...
No problem.
Right. The point is that because there's a cost involved for them or a risk involved for them, they're allowed to charge. Shlomo, you were going to say?
No.
So the same thing is going to be true for the doctor. He has an investment. So even if it is a communal investment, there has to be some limit on it. You're not going to say, therefore the doctor can say, I want to charge the community whatever I like, or the drug producer can say, I'm going to charge the community whatever I like. That brings us to our next phase. So, yeah.
Well, is this rules in pertaining from one Jew to another Jew? So in other words, if you took that position that you shouldn't be charging, so then the doctor says, no problem, I'll go take care of Gentiles. In which case, then you don't have Jewish doctors taking care of Jewish
doctors. Right. So this is a good question, and the answer is it depends on how you understand the basis for the obligation to heal. Because, as we noted before, we mentioned three different sources for the obligation to heal. In truth, there are more. And even though some of those sources for the obligation to heal are Jew-specific, this is what you do for your family, others will apply to any human being. So, for example, the Rambam writes, in discussing the laws of tzedakah, he says, "Rachmav al kol ma'asav, Hashem's mercy is upon all of his creations, therefore you have a duty to display mercy for all of his creations." So, he's not going to be able to get out of some mitzvah and say, well, there's no mitzvah for me to treat this person, therefore I can do it for free. And therefore I can do it, I'm sorry, and charge. He's always going to have some kind of an imperative. So, is there a cap on what the merchant can charge under these justifications? So, some of them come with a built-in cap. In other words, if I'm able to charge for my materials, I can't charge exorbitantly. I can only charge whatever the materials cost me. If I'm able to charge based on what I could have earned elsewhere, there's going to be a limit on what I can put under what I would have earned elsewhere. Well, I would have been a real estate developer. There's certain realistic limits to what that would have been. But beyond that, we have certain principles of Jewish law, which I'm now going to take out of the realm of the doctor in practice and put on the drug manufacturer specifically, because they apply much in a much cleaner way when you deal with the case of materials specifically. So the first potential issue of the two that we're going to talk about is ona'a. Ona'a is a prohibition against causing somebody to pay too much or causing somebody to charge too little for a product. So it can happen by a seller can be guilty of ona'a by charging too much. A buyer can be guilty of ona'a by paying too little, by offering too little, if you do it by virtue of deception. Meaning, this is not a prohibition against overcharging broadly. This is not a prohibition against underpaying broadly. It's specifically doing so in a way that the other party in the transaction isn't going to realize what you are doing. That's what we're talking about. It is prohibited in the Torah in Parshas Bahar, if you take a look at source number 15, the end of the book of Vayikra of Leviticus. When you sell merchandise to your friend or buy from your friend, one may not abuse his brother. There's a prohibition against abusing the other, and that's the way you understand the word ona'a. So how much is too much? So in source number 16, we establish it as 1/6 of the purchase. Now, there's some debate, is this one of those 1/6 which is really 1/5, meaning do we mean 16% or do we mean 20%? I'm not getting into that conversation right now. It's not so relevant for us. But the point is, there is a certain percentage which is okay, and beyond that, not. Why is a certain percentage okay? So one argument for why it's okay is because people forgive a certain amount of overage. Because, number one, you can't be precise. You know, this is exactly what it cost me in order to produce this. And number two, because this is the way people do business. You can't imagine.
How are you going to find markets on it?
I'm coming back to it in 1 second. Good question. But the other challenge is, if you're going to tell somebody he's only allowed to sell it based on what he paid for it, then he's going to be out of business tomorrow. You can't live that way. This is the way we do business. So now you ask the question of what exactly is market value in this? So normally speaking, and I actually cut out some sources I had originally on this because I wanted to fit everything in, but I have sources I can show you on it. Normally the way we evaluate it is cost of materials, as well as cost of your value-added investment. Whatever you did in order to produce this, based on what it would be on the open market. What is the norm for people to charge? And then the really tricky question is, what happens in an era of globalization? Is it what we would charge locally, or what we would charge somewhere else? In an era when you can have chain stores, and they will charge one thing in one area, and one thing in another area, based on what they know people locally can pay, how do you do this as well? Such that there actually is an argument in Jewish law that says the laws of ona'a can't really apply to the way we do business today. It made sense in a world in which there was a particular community and people manufactured things locally and people bought and sold things locally and the competition was clearly defined and that it worked. There's an argument that suggests that ona'a is not really so relevant today, but I will actually make it worse, because it's really hard to apply ona'a when you're dealing with medicine. Why is it hard to apply ona'a to medicine in particular? Because appropriate prices of medicine are really unclear, right? It's very difficult, especially if you're dealing with a product that this guy's the sole manufacturer of. Really, how are you going to define what actually makes sense for this? I brought you source 18. I'm going to come back to 17 in a moment. Source number 18, Rabbi Yaakov Yeshaya Blau, a judge on rabbinical courts in Israel until he passed away a couple of years ago, he says, some say there is no law of ona'a for an item which has no known price. There is no known price for it. And some also say that where the item is worth this price for this person, there is no law of ona'a. Meaning, the guy who's sick is willing to pay a whole lot more than somebody who's healthy would pay, right? The person who's healthy may look at the product and say, well, it costs this for that, and I'm going to come up with an analysis and say, this is what it's worth. And the guy who's sick is going to say, just tell me what I'm supposed to, you know, tell me what number to put on the check. He's not terribly focused on what is it actually worth. So that also shoots a hole in the application of ona'ah to issues of medicine. But I think in any case, you really throw out the ona'ah as an argument because of what I said in defining the laws of ona'ah, which is that they're really about deception. I brought you source number 17 as one example of this from the Sefer HaChinuch, where Rabbi Aaron Halevi is assumed to be the author. It was written anonymously, but many believe that he was the author. And he says, in explaining this law of ona'ah, he says it would be inappropriate to take someone's property via lies or trickery. Each person earns through hard work that which God chooses to give him in his world with honesty and integrity. Each individual will benefit from this principle, for just as he will not oppress others, so they will not oppress him. That's why you have this law of ona'ah. But he makes it contingent on lies and trickery. So what if everybody's above board? Right? As is the case. Meaning, we know what it costs them to produce Daraprim. We know what the numbers are. He's not dishonest about what his costs are. He's just saying, and I'm going to charge you this, and you're going to pay for it because you want this drug. That's the situation. So he's not guilty of ona'ah. Because he wasn't dishonest. He told everybody exactly what was involved. And that was used against him when they said, well, you're overcharging, because they all knew what the numbers ought to be. However, there's a second issue, besides ona'ah, and that is a rabbinic prohibition against what's called in Hebrew hafka'at she'arim. Hafka'at she'arim, literally, releasing of prices. Right? That's a good translation, I think, Shlomo. Releasing of, to be mafkia.
Profiteering, no?
Yeah, well, that's what it comes down to. I was trying to think of a good word for lahafkia as a direct translation, but yes, it's profiteering. That's exactly what it is. Meaning, or price gouging would be another term for it. Driving up the price on something unnecessarily, and thereby creating economic hardship for consumers. Having nothing to do with deception, there is a law in the Torah. It starts number 20. Number 19 is just a supporting source for number 18. But take a look at number 20, where the Torah instructs us, if your brother becomes needy, his hand falls among you, you shall hold him, meaning support him, stranger or settler, and he shall live with you. Take neither neshech nor tarbit from him, that's a reference to charging interest, and revere your God, and then the last clause, and your brother's life shall be with you. From which we understand that there is an imperative to look after your brother's life. You have to make sure that they are able to survive. And on that basis, the sages said, we don't want people engaging in pricing, which is going to make it difficult for people to live. Now, unlike ona'ah, this is specifically regarding things that people need in order to live. So if you're dealing with a product that is a luxury item, this law will not apply. But if you deal with medicine, you better believe it applies. If you take a look at source number 21, you find the sages talking about various bad business practices which come under this heading, hoarding produce, right, to drive up a price, lending usuriously, reducing the eifa measure. The eifa is a volume measure. So reducing the amount of food that you're going to provide in the in the sale.
A rabbinic or is this a Torah law? Based on the Torah. But
right.
The rabbis went off and used it as a base. Does that mean?
Correct.
It's rabbinic
based on a biblical concept. But the Torah doesn't explicitly state anything, and so this is understood to be a rabbinic application of a biblical principle. Now, there is, again, some room for market fluctuation within this, and there's the 1/6 cap as well when you're dealing with this. So if you take a look at source number 22 from the Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, the court must establish appointees over prices. And what that means is there are people who are supposed to circulate in the market and make sure that no one is price gouging, so that people will not profit as they choose. One may not profit on life necessities like wine, oil, and flour, but only 1/6.
All commodities are
Well, that's exactly what it is. But only those that are defined as necessities. Right. Well, except that I'm not sure you can call metals something that is necessary for life. Yes, no, food, yes. I mean, you see his example. You see the example. Wine, oil, and flour. Now, wine may not be considered a necessity today. I don't know.
So you're allowed to own any shares of commodities?
Yeah,
based on this. Because
that's not what he's saying. What he's saying is you're not allowed to charge too much. The question that you're asking would be, is a shareholder responsible for the pricing that the company does? And that's a very interesting question in its own right. That goes back to the question which we've discussed on occasion of how I view corporate structures in halacha.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
It's a curious thing because if you're price gouging on a common commodity in the shuk,
yeah,
why wouldn't somebody go to the next stall? How will you survive?
So often what we're talking about is somebody who dominates the market. What they have is unique, or they have the quantities that people need, or they have it earlier than other people have it available.
The description here is things that are quite common.
The wine, oil, and flour.
Yeah.
Right, but what will often happen is that people will work together and elevate the prices.
Okay.
Keep in mind, by the way, this didn't develop in a vacuum. Rabbi Dr. Aaron Levine notes that this law first appears not in a Mishnah, but in a Tosefta. Tosefta is a collection of added material that doesn't show up in the Mishnah. Sometimes because it wasn't, sometimes because it's actually, it was questionable in terms of its authenticity and its binding character as law. Sometimes it's considered redundant from the Mishnah, but it's not in the Mishnah itself. And Rabbi Dr. Levine notes that Mishnah is canonized and finalized in the year 220 Common Era. Tosefta, he says, if I remember correctly, somewhere around 240 or 250. And he argues, from the fact that this becomes accepted as law, we see that it wasn't considered inauthentic, and it isn't redundant with Mishnah, because it isn't stated in the Mishnah anywhere. He argues that that means that this rabbinic decree was actually promulgated post-Mishnah. And therefore he pins it on between the year 220 and the year 250 as when the rabbis actually put this decree in place, which is very interesting because the Romans of the time had similar laws. Diocletian in particular is known for this type of price protection within Roman society, because they were concerned about price gouging as well. So the argument is that if medicine is a necessity, you're not allowed to overcharge for it. Now, Moshe asked a question before. Maybe we need to distinguish between, I think it was Moshe who asked it, between producers and retailers. No, it wasn't Russia. So somebody else asked a question towards the beginning about the difference between producers and retailers.
Well, it's talking about drugs.
Right. So so maybe we'll make a distinction there. The truth of the matter is that there are those who want to draw such a distinction. There's a passage in the Talmud that talks about egg farmers and says that the egg farmers are limited to a 100% profit. And so the commentators ask, what do you mean 100% profit? It's 1/6. Where'd you get the 100% profit? So they give a couple of answers. One answer is that egg farming involved great strain, and therefore they were licensed to charge more as compensation for the strain. And the other answer that's given in a Tosfot there, it's this all, if anyone wants to look it up, it's Bava Basra Tzadi Aleph. The other answer is producers are different. Society wants to create an incentive for people to produce goods, and therefore the limitation on raising prices is specifically on
R&D.
People later in it.
The costs are R&D.
Yeah, essentially.
That's where the costs are.
Right.
But the person that buys the company doesn't have those costs. The initial costs are just in the...
Correct, and that raises a very interesting question. In the case of Turing Pharmaceuticals and Valiant as well, they didn't actually invest in the development.
Exactly.
Their response will be that we're going to turn the profits back into investment in other things. And they try to make that argument until they get kicked out. But, until then, they try. So what we've seen so far is, number one, there is an issue of not making a profit on a mitzvah, which will include potentially healing others. We've seen three justifications for charging. Justification number one, charging for elements that aren't inherent in the mitzvah, whether that means loss of time from other pursuits, whether that means strain, whether that means materials. They're not involved in the act of the mitzvah. Second, why are you looking at me to be the one to do this? There are other people who could do it. And third is the community's decision that we wish to pay. The onah argument won't really hold water here because there's no deception. Everybody knows what it costs. It's very clear. But what may apply is the concern for price gouging by driving up the cost of a necessity. I had a piece here on what the community is able to do to compel somebody to comply with the law. So I'm just going to say one thing about it because we're at our limit on time. And that is to note that rabbinical courts do have the ability to compel people to aid others. One example of it, and you can see the sources here, is that if there's a moel who insists that I will not do a bris milah unless I charge X, and there's a particular case in which the father isn't able to afford it. So the rabbinical court is able to take over and say, we compel the moel to do the bris. You generally don't want a moel to act under compulsion. It's just not a good idea. But they're able to do that, either because we view the court as like the father of orphans, and this child is not being taken care of by the parent in this way, so the court steps in. Or because they have a basic obligation to take care of people if doctors don't, or in this case, if a moel doesn't. I'm sorry. The other way to look at it is because they're not. It's not about them taking care of the kid. They're taking care of the moel. The moel has an obligation to do a mitzvah, so they're just helping him towards doing that. But they can't compel him to do it for free. Well, if the moel has a mitzvah also to provide bris milah. The argument is that he can because he has the knowledge. I'm going to make sure to finish this and I'll stick around for questions. But the other argument is that they're helping the moel. But either way, they're not able to compel him to do it for free. They still have to pay him what is appropriate. They can just tell him you can't charge overly much. But they are able to do that. And the argument would then be they are able to compel people not to overcharge for luxuries. And in fact, those people who we mentioned earlier who are delegated to oversee measures and so on.
Luxuries or necessities?
For necessities, I'm sorry. But those people who are delegated to do this actually have the ability, as they circulate in the marketplace, to enforce it even physically, in order to bring people into line and to make sure they don't overcharge. So there were teeth to this. There were teeth to this law as well. You can see it in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, in source number 27. They may strike him and punish him appropriately. I am not necessarily recommending that be done to the officers of Valiant and Turing and so forth. But that shows you the seriousness with which the sages viewed this. Again, I can thank Steve for making all of this possible. Next week, Rabbi Ziering will be back, and he will speak on arm sales. May a Jew profit from weapons. So enjoy. Thank you very much.